So tonight, as you guys know, we are in Revelation chapter 17, and we've been working towards this for a while. So we've most of you guys are regulars here, so you're familiar with it. You'll notice tonight, as we look at chapter 18, this is another one of those sections where we see a lot of terminology that's been used throughout the Revelation kind of get woven together and mixed together. And we see that in a lot of different places in the Bible where it has this very conclusive feeling to it. Now, we mentioned, I think it was last week, it was either last week or the week before, when we were looking at chapter 17, that there are two characters that are... Well, definitely last week, there are two characters that God is proclaiming judgment against. He's proclaiming judgment against the beast and proclaiming judgment against the harlot, or Babylon, or Mystery Babylon, if you want to call it Mystery Babylon. And there are these two places. And we also said that these two places can be understood in a variety of ways. One is that the beast is a man, or the beast is a government, or the beast is a system, and all three of those would be appropriate. If you want to say the beast is the Antichrist and the Antichrist is one dude, yes, you're correct. If you want to say he's a kingdom, yes, you're correct. If you want to say he's a government, yes, you're correct. And Daniel would support that, and the ancient concept of kingship would support that too, that the king and the state were united. Borders did exist, but geopolitical borders were not really the idea of the kingdom. The idea of the land being the kingdom, it was there, but the government structure was united with the idea of the person of the king. In a similar way, we said, well, if that's true about the beast, is that also true about the woman dressed in scarlet and purple who rides upon the back of this terrifying beast? Is the woman, is Mystery Babylon, or the whore Babylon, or just Babylon, is she a person? Is she a system? Is she a government? What is she? And you could make a really good case for any or all of those things. Now, I mentioned last week that my take on Babylon is that Babylon is false religion united into one world religion. Now, you could make a case, this is not my case, but you could make a case for whore Babylon and the false prophet being united. We know that the false prophet is a religious figure. So the false Holy Spirit, the false prophet, the second beast, the beast coming out of the earth, we know he's a religious figure. We know that he is most likely a Jew. Or at least a lot of people take it that he is a Jew or he is from Israel. We went into that. If you guys have questions about that, we can cover it again. And we also know that there is a good evidence that Mystery Babylon or Babylon is the city of Jerusalem. That Babylon does not mean Babylon here, but Babylon means Jerusalem. So if that's the case, and we know that believing Jews have fled out of the city of Jerusalem and are living in the hills, and we could point to Matthew, Mark, and Luke in their end times part, where Jesus says, when you see the abomination of desolation, what are you supposed to do? Flee to the mountains. So they've left Jerusalem. So you could make a case for that. That's not the case I make, but you could make one, and I think it would be a really strong argument. You could make a good one. But tonight, we're going to look at the fall of Babel, or the fall of Babylon. And then, depending on how far we get, either next week or in a couple weeks, we're going to look at the fall of, or the destruction of the beast and the armies of the Antichrist. So before we look at the text, does anybody have any questions? Yeah. No, scarlet would not have been a color associated with shame at this time. Now, I mentioned last week, somebody said that scarlet was a color of royalty, and it was. Scarlet was an ancient color of royalty before they were, because it was the closest, it was one of the most rare colors you could get. And also, the seashell, I want to call it Myrmex or Myrmorex. Myrmex means ant, so I know it's not that. It might be like Myrmorex, or it's something, the seashells, the shells from those sea snails that you smash, and then you can create purple. They call it Tyrian purple. You can make Tyrian purple from that. Well, Thyatiran purple, like Lydia, the dealer in purple cloth, what she most likely had was a kind of a scarlety red color. Depending on how you dye it, whether you use alum in the dye or different things you can use in the dye, it'll go anywhere from kind of a light, kind of a tomato soup color to a really dark red, depending on obviously the amount of what you use. And it's used, typically use madder root to make that. Madder root grows in that area of Turkey in some abundance. And so the dyers got really good at dyeing that. So, but scarlet was generally the color of Roman uniforms, of the legionaries wore scarlet. And there were laws that prevented only equestrians in Roman society were allowed to wear purple. Now, if you were a king from another society, you were maybe allowed to wear purple. But in Rome, only equestrians were allowed to wear purple. So purple was definitely a royal color. Scarlet could be a royal color, but I think most likely it's being associated with military power, with the Roman legions at that time. So I know that's probably a longer answer than what you wanted, but anyways. So any other questions or comments before we dive in? Okay, so we're not going to read the whole thing. I think what we'll do this week is we'll just read little sections at a time, and then we'll do our own comments, and then we'll read the verses, just because I think that'll work a little bit better tonight. So chapter 18 from my translation, verses 1 through 3. After these things, I saw another angel coming down out of heaven, having great authority, and the earth was lighted out of his glory, and he cried in a strong voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." And it became a dwelling of demons, and a place of all unclean spirits, and a prison of unclean birds, and a prison of unclean beasts, and of hated things. Because out of the wine of the passion of her fornication, all the nations of the earth have drunk, and all the kings of the earth have fornicated with her, and the merchants of the earth, out of the ability, or that kind of means the strength or the power of her luxury, were enriched. Okay, so let's just pause right there. What stands out to you guys? What do you think is significant here? What do you want to pay attention to?
Yeah.
So that's an excellent point. And I think that's a good counter argument to that position. Like I said, that's not my position, but I think it's one that you can make a decent case for, because there's a lot of disagreement on what Babylon is. And like I said about earlier about the city on seven hills, I don't know what that is. I think you can make a great argument for that being the restored. I mean, it is the restored Roman Empire. Whether it's situated on that town on the Tiber, that's another question. A lot of people would say no, it's not. And we know that. I mean, look at Turkey. Turkey is part of the EU. When you look at the restored Roman Empire, we think Europe. It doesn't have to be Europe. And actually, it hadn't happened at this time because Diocletian hadn't split the Roman Empire. But the Roman Empire historically, you know, towards the end had two capitals. And the capital in Byzantium, later called Constantinople, outlasted. It had a longer lifespan than Imperial Rome, because really Imperial Rome only lasted a couple hundred years. The entire Roman Empire lasted over 1,000. The Western Roman Empire lasted 800 as the Western Roman Empire. It was part of Rome in Byzantium for a long time before that. So there's a lot of longevity in Turkey. We don't think of Turkey as being the Roman Empire, but guess what? Turkey is part of the EU, tentatively, but it's part of the EU, and North Africa was part of the Roman Empire. Saudi Arabia, at least parts of Saudi Arabia, parts of Persia, even pushing a little bit further east into Yugoslavia, places that in used to be called Dalmatia, that's where Dalmatians come from, but that area, up even getting close to the Black Sea. So all of that was part of the Roman Empire at its peak, including, you know, England and all that jazz. So we think, oh, well, Rome, if the Roman Empire is restored, it has to be situated on Rome. Well, no, the center of power doesn't have to be in Rome. The power was not necessarily situated in Rome during its height. So again, we've got Byzantium, we've got Constantinople, Istanbul, whatever you want to call it. But we also know from Daniel that the Roman Empire is fractured at this point. Whatever empire the beast has is split up. Now we mentioned, you know, the ten horns correspond to the ten toes. I think ten is an actual number. I think 10 should be taken seriously as a number of geopolitical units that are united with the beast at that time. Now, do they have to be individual countries? No. It could be the European Union and OPEC and a bunch of other units joined together with him. It could be 10 countries. We don't know. Depending on what Russia does, there might only be 10 countries in Europe before the end of all this stuff. You know, we just don't know what's going to happen. But I tend to think that 10 is probably a literal number. Now, I'm probably blathering on a little bit more about than what you wanted, but my point is, I agree with you. The fact that all of the nations of the world are united with Babylon suggests that linking this with the city of Jerusalem probably isn't the best argument. But probably there's a headquarters somewhere. There's probably a leader. If I'm correct, which I think I am, because I don't go around saying stuff I don't think is right, but if I'm correct, and this is a one world religion type thing, it probably has a leader. The World Council of Churches has a leader. You know, our denomination has a leader. Every organization has a leader. Well, people are limited by time and space, so he has to have a headquarters. You know, we have Ashland. You know, every group has a headquarters. So where could it be? We'll talk about that a little bit more. I think there's a very simple answer. But before I get to that, does anybody else have any other questions or comments? Yeah, in the tribulation, we'd be in the last 3.5. I think we're in the last couple months, maybe, of the tribulation. The armies are going to have to assemble around Jerusalem at the Battle of Armageddon. That may be happening simultaneously with this. I don't know, but I would say that probably we're in the last months anyways. If you guys want, we can turn. There is, I believe it's in, especially if my notes are helping me, Jeremiah chapter 9. If you go to Jeremiah chapter 9, I think it's here. There's also Isaiah chapter 13 is significant here. Jeremiah 9, let's see, where is Jeremiah? I'm in Isaiah. I think I could find it. No, it's not. It's not Jeremiah 9, I'm sorry. Okay, so looking at Isaiah chapter 13, Isaiah has this message about Babylon, and he talks about the destruction of Babylon. And if you look at chapter 13, verse 20, Babylon will never rise again. Generation after generation will come and go, but the land will never be lived in. Nomads will refuse to camp there, and shepherds will not allow their sheep to stay overnight. Wild animals of the desert will move into the ruined city. The houses will be haunted by howling creatures. Ostriches will live among the ruins, and wild goats will come there to dance. Hyenas will howl in its fortresses, and jackals will make their dens in its palaces. Babylon's days are numbered. Its time for destruction will soon come. Okay, so here is language that is very, very similar to what we see here. And I believe there's another place. I think it might be in Jeremiah or Ezekiel. I don't know for sure. That's why I told you to maybe flip to that Jeremiah passage. I knew that this was here. I think and Isaiah chapter 34 also talks a little bit about it. We're not going to turn there just for sake of time, but there are several places that mention this about the fall of Babylon, and that Babylon, when it's destroyed, is going to be destroyed utterly, and it's never going to be re-inhabited. Now, Vernon McGee mentions this about the city of Edom. So he talks about it in the book of Obadiah. In the book of Obadiah, the prophet Obadiah mentions that Edom, the Edomite peoples, are going to be destroyed, and their fortresses are never going to be re-inhabited. So how many, you guys have all seen Indiana Jones, right? Yeah, okay. So that place he goes to is in Jordan, and it's near the city of Petra. So Petra, you guys, I'm sure you've heard of Petra. You know your history. Like, Petra is that gigantic city that's just carved into the rocks in Jordan. It was an incredibly well-fortified city. In fact, there are some places, and I've read this in commentaries, and I've never been able to find like really good sources for it. But there are people who say that Petra used to be a banking center, that people used to put their money there because it was basically unconquerable. Alexander the Great, when he went through there, said that he would never try to march an army in there to conquer it. Well, so it's an incredibly defensible place. It's everything's ready to go, made for living, but God said it will never be inhabited again, and it never has been. Nobody has ever, there have been a couple attempts to restart society there in Petra, and every one of them has failed and failed miserably. I don't know exactly what the issue is. I don't know why they can't make a go of it. Maybe because it's in the desert and there's not a lot of water. I don't know. Or because God said so, right? So we've got that. So one of the reasons why I tend to think Deanne makes a really good point that Babylon is not Jerusalem is because there is going to be a new Jerusalem. Well, you could say, well, Luke, there's going to be a new Jerusalem, so maybe old Jerusalem will never be inhabited again. I don't know, because the new Jerusalem doesn't come until 1,000 years after old Jerusalem, and people are living in old Jerusalem for 1,000 years. So I don't buy that. I don't think that's a great argument. And then we get verse 3, out of the wine of the passion of her fornication, all the nations of the earth have drunk, and all the kings of the earth have fornicated, etc. Now, this is really interesting, because this sounds a lot like what we read in the previous chapter, in chapter 17, doesn't it? But in chapter 17, it sounds like a punishment. Let's see if we can't find that here. Let's see. Chapter 17. Made drunk on the wine of her fornication. But this statement, the wine of the passion, where is that? God is going to make her drink it. I saw a woman drunk out of the blood. Yeah, and the angel said, mighty marvel. Where was it? I thought it was right here. Okay, I'm sorry. It was in chapter 16. Chapter 16, starting in verse 17. I'll start way back. And the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and there came a great voice out of the temple from the throne saying, it has begun, or it is finished. And there were lightnings and voices and thunders, and there was a great earthquake, the kind of earthquake there hasn't been from the time men began living on the earth. The earthquake was so large. It was large in this way, so that the city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and Babylon the Great was remembered by God. All right, so this is where it gets really interesting. So Babylon the Great was remembered by God to give her the cup of the wine of the passion of his wrath, and every island fled, and the mountains couldn't be found, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is clearly a punishment. But here we see that because out of the wine of the passion of her fornication, all the nations of the earth have drunk, and the kings of the earth, etc. And we see similar language in chapter 17. But all the way back in chapter 16, this sounds like a punishment that God is pouring out on them. God is giving her the cup of his wine of wrath. So here's my question to you guys, and you don't have to answer it right now. You can think about it or something. But my question is, are these the same cups? Is the cup of the passion of his wrath the same as the cup of the passion of her fornication? Are they the same cup? Maybe we'll come back to that later. But that's something for you to noodle on, because I think there's something maybe there. Anyways. Okay, so you're not even going to think about it. You're like, no, Luke. No, they're not the same. Okay. So the question I would throw back to you. So you're saying it's not the passion, it's not the cup of the passion of God's wrath, because it's something she's doing. It's the passion of her fornication. So my question would be, who hardened Pharaoh's heart? But didn't Pharaoh harden his own heart? Well, the text tells us that Pharaoh hardened his heart a couple times. So the reason I ask that, and I'm not trying to stir up a whole hornet's nest here. My point is simply, are we maybe looking at things from two different angles here? Because maybe, and I would tend to agree with you, maybe what Babylon is doing is exactly what she wants to do. She wants, whether she's a person or a system or a government or whatever, she wants to teach false religion. She wants to gain power and authority and wisdom, wisdom after a fashion. She wants to gain accolades and strength through giving a false gospel. But God wants her to do the same thing, Because God, just like with Pharaoh, God began hardening Pharaoh's heart so that he could gain glory through Pharaoh's destruction. Again, and I've said this a lot of times, and you don't have to agree with me. I'm just saying you can make the argument. You don't have to agree with me. But the Exodus is really, really crucial. It is. I would say that it's impossible to really grasp what's going on in the book of Revelation without a firm understanding of the Exodus. Now, a lot of people point to, well, you got to understand Daniel. That's true. You got to understand Zechariah. Sure, absolutely. You got to understand Ezekiel. Definitely. You should understand John. For sure, right? All those things are important. But a lot of the subtle things, a lot of the motifs, a lot of the themes that we see are Exodus themes, and they're subtle. They're not always, you know, right there on the nose. A lot of times you've got to pay attention, but you can see how John's thinking is shaped by the Exodus, which is of course natural, right? John was a Jew. John was a Jew living in post-exile, like post-Babylonian exile Israel, and so he grew up hearing about the Egyptian bondage. He grew up hearing about the Babylonian bondage. He grew up hearing about the Exodus from Egypt. He grew up hearing about the Exodus from Babylon. Like, this is a huge theme that builds his thinking. And why else would that be so significant? Because what were they living under at that time? Roman bondage. They were a client state to Rome. And all of their messianic hopes were built on the idea that Judea would be freed of their Roman oppressors. And so for John and for good Jews of that time, the Exodus, this idea that God with a mighty hand is going to send a Savior who is going to destroy the oppressive powers that rule over you, that was major. That formed a major part of his thinking. And so we shouldn't be surprised that these themes show up in the Revelation. Now you ask the question, Luke. You say, well, Luke, it makes it sound like John was making this up out of his own head. Well, that's not what I mean. If that's what you hear me saying, then I'm not being clear enough. When I talk about, and this happens in sermons too, when I talk about Luke or John or Mark, and I talk about their personality shining through into the text, I do not in any way mean to say that the Holy Spirit didn't inspire it. What I believe is that somehow John, I won't hold my translation. That's not very good. In this book, when John wrote this, John said exactly what John wanted to say. In ways of thought and in forms of thinking that were natural to John, because John was a real person. But at the same time, God, the Holy Spirit, said exactly what the Holy Spirit wanted to say. Now there's a fancy $5 word for this. It's called plenary verbal inspiration. Okay, you know, if there's not a test later that you know of, it'll be a surprise exam. But you don't need to know that. But that's the idea. There are a couple different views of inspiration, right? There's inspiration, which is like spiritual inspiration, where John just wrote what he wanted, and God was like, "Yeah, nice job, John. I like that." Okay, that's not good enough. It has to be God's words. The other side is called dictation, right? I don't know if some of you guys have, I'm sure, you take dictation all the time, right? So, okay, so if you take dictation, can you just say whatever you feel like? No. Would you have a job in the world of law very long if that's how you took dictation? No. Okay, right. So if you're taking dictation, it's got to be verbatim. It's got to be word perfect. That's dictation theory, is that God turned the person into a little pen, and God just said whatever God wanted to. The personality of the author had nothing to do with it. Well, I reject that too. Now you say, well, Luke, how does plenary verbal inspiration work? How does it come down so that John says exactly what John wants to say, and God says exactly what God wants to say? Well, I don't know. Get somebody smart to answer that question. I don't know. But I believe that's what happened. Anyways, what were we talking about? I don't know. Anyways, Any questions? Go ahead. Yeah, we're talking about the Passion of the Wine. Thank you. Let's see. Somebody pays attention. I'm glad I don't have to. So we're talking about the Passion of the Wine. We'll come back to that. Like I said, nobody has to agree with me. There's no law about that, but I'm not even sure I agree with me. But I think it's something interesting to consider. Chapter 18, let's do verses 4 through 8. And I heard another voice coming out of heaven saying, come out, my people, out of her and out of her plagues, so that you will not take them. Because her sins were touched until the heaven, and God remembered her unrighteous deeds. Repay her as also she repaid, and double it, the double according to her works. In the cup which she mixed, mix her a double. As much as she glorified and luxuriated, such give her torment and mourning. Because in her heart she said that I am seated a queen and a widow and will not be in mourning, and I will not behold it. Because of this, in 1 hour her plagues will be present, death and mourning and famine, and in fire she will be burned up, because the Lord God, the one judging her, is strong. Okay, so that is really terrible, terrible English. I apologize for that. That was the best English I could do and still be very literal. You can read your own English translation to get that. But first thing I'll mention, I have a footnote there. If you look at verse chapter 14, verse 10, there's the same combination of the same phraseology is used in chapter 14, verse 10, which says, and he will drink out of, am I in chapter 14? And he will drink out of the wine of the passion of God, which is mixed, unmixed, in the cup of his wrath, and they will be tormented in fire and sulfur before holy angels and before the Lamb. Okay, so again, we've got this idea of drinking out of cups mentioned with the beast. And so we see a connection of drinking and punishment, wrath, passion, and now we see it, but in chapter 14, we see it with the beast. It's a warning not to worship the beast, because then you'll have to drink this cup of punishment from God. And it will be mixed double, unmixed. So it'll be mixed unmixed, which is, that sounds like a really silly, like a weird thing to say, mixed unmixed. Well, part of what mixed unmixed means is that wine in the ancient world was very, very often mixed. It would be mixed with water. It would be mixed with other wines. It would be mixed with sweeteners. So how many of you guys have ever had Italian wine, like Chianti or something like that? Okay. Is it very sweet? Is it, yeah. Really, really dry. Really good with pasta. Okay, yeah. Well, ancient wine, and we can't say for sure, but what we know of ancient, at least Roman wine, is that Roman wine tended to be extremely strong and very harsh. It was very strong. There were Italian wine growers, Italian vintners, basically had a rule of thumb, which was they had these enormous barrels, because they would make everything in these gigantic casks. And that you make wine, and they pour the wine in, and they would say, this will be drinkable in about 50 years. And there were a bunch of young Italian vintners about 40, 50 years ago, and they're like, that's dumb. I want to sell my wine today. They're like, we want to sell fresh wine, because the French, a lot of French love young wine. They love a young Beaujolais. They love young sweet wines. But to do it, you had to use American oak. Or maybe another kind of oak from Europe that's similar to American oak that would do it. And these old guys, these old vintners are like, no, you let your wine sit for 100 years and then you drink it. That's how we do. Well, in the ancient world, wine could be very, very strong and very acidic. And you got to remember, we've had 2,000 years of cultivation of grapes to get wines that have complex flavors, that have sweetness, that have, you know, non-fermentable sugars in them. So wine today is quite a bit different. It was very common to mix your wines with honey, with various herbs and spices, with water a lot of times, with other things that would mellow out the flavor. Also, wine would sit in casks. A lot of times it would sit in clay jars, right? They would put it in clay jars and they'd maybe seal it up with some wax or something to allow it to stay. The Odyssey talks about this, the pottery jars that they had. Well, most of this wasn't glazed, so there was a lot of stuff going on, and it could get kind of vinegary if it wasn't entirely held secure, and a lot of dregs. Filtering wasn't a thing then. So if you're getting unmixed wine, so it's irony. God's saying, give it to her, mix her a drink that's unmixed. There's no honey added. There's no sweetener. You've got all the dregs. You're not filtering out the dregs. You're not pouring it back and forth, because pouring wine back and forth was something they did. Now, if you've ever brewed beer, especially people who've done beer, and people who've done wine know this too, what do you do to get rid of the dregs? Well, you sit the wine, and with wine they call it racking. at least in the bottles, it's called racking. Well, you'd let the wine sit, and you'd let it sit for, with beer, you only do it for a couple weeks, but with wine, they would do it for months. You let it sit, and then what do? You open it up very gently, and you get another thing, and you pour the wine out so that you leave the dregs behind. Well, God's saying, we're not going to do that. You're getting the full thing. You're getting all the little floaties, all the vinegar, all the little bugs and stuff. You're getting it all. Well, anyways, we get a similar, we get really similar terminology here in chapter 18. And so this is a really important theme in Revelation is drinking out of this cup. And it's an important biblical theme. Anyways, that's a lot of me talking. What do you guys think? What stands out to you here in chapter 18? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Yeah, come out, my people, out of her and out of the plagues. So yeah, it would certainly suggest that some of God's anointed, some of the people sealed, well, either people who are sealed or people who are going to be saved and haven't been yet, because that's a possibility. I mean, the text doesn't tell us that happens, but it's possible. But we have this phrase, yeah, so it suggests that he has people that are in Babylon. If Babylon is a place and not just an idea, or it could be that there are people who are true believers in Jesus, but they're going to churches or they're going to synagogues that are associated with this one world religion. Probably a lot of it just depends on how you interpret this. Or this is another direct allusion to the Exodus, or a direct allusion to what? The Babylonian captivity, right? So come out of her, my people, come out of her. We see that in chapter 10, verse 4 here of this book. And then there's also a reference, Isaiah 48, 20 has something similar to this. Isaiah 52, 11, Jeremiah 51, 6. This idea of exiting the Babylonian captivity, I think this is almost, I would have to check, and we might as well since I've already got Isaiah open, but I believe one of those places is almost a verbatim quotation where God says, come out, 48:20, leave Babylon and the Babylonians, singing as you go, shout to the ends of the earth that the Lord has redeemed his servants, the people of Israel. So that's there. 52:11 says, go now, leave the bonds of slavery, put Babylon behind you and everything it represents, for it is unclean to you. You are the Lord's people. Purify yourselves, you who carry the vessel of the Lord. Jeremiah 51:6. That's right at the very end. Let's see if that gives us anything. 51:6. Flee from Babylon. Save yourselves. Don't get trapped in her punishment. It is the Lord's time for vengeance. He will fully repay her. Babylon has been like a golden cup in the Lord's hands, a cup from which he has made the whole earth drink and go mad. But now suddenly Babylon too has fallen. Weep for her and give her medicine. Perhaps she can yet be healed. We would have helped her if we could, but nothing can save her now. Let her go. Abandon her. Return now to your own land, for her judgment will be so great it cannot be measured. The Lord has vindicated us. Come, let us announce in Jerusalem everything the Lord has done. We could continue to read, but I think you guys see the point. A lot of themes that are very similar in Isaiah, a lot of themes in Jeremiah. Go ahead. Yeah, excellent. Yeah, Isaiah 52, that's a great reference right there. I think that's even more evidence that Babylon here is not Jerusalem. At least if we're going to read this in a straightforward manner, the Old Testament references clearly differentiate these places. Now, you could make an argument that not all of Israel is Israel. There is a spiritual Jerusalem and there is an earthly Jerusalem. Paul makes an argument like this. I do not make this argument. I don't think this is a very good one. But you could make the argument that he's saying you need to get out of corrupt Jerusalem, and when Jesus returns, he's going to make it the good Jerusalem. I don't think that makes sense. I don't think that's the right way to interpret this. But you could make that argument. Again, just because you can make an argument doesn't make it a good one. It just means that it's really hard to refute. Anyways, thank you for that reference. Yeah, and it's the Lord who's bringing them out. So that's an excellent point. Anything else we see here in chapter 18, verses 4 through 8.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because you say that, the double. And again, I think it's one of the prophets, I forget where, but they say, the Lord has paid us back more than we deserve. The Lord has paid us back double. And so there's this kind of inversion of what happened in the Babylonian captivity versus what's happening here. And again, the Babylonian captivity and the Exodus, very closely related, very, very similar thematically, and we see these themes here. So yeah, so great point. And then again, the irony that we see, you know, as much as she glorified herself and lived in luxury, to that degree give her torment and mourning, which, by the way, great argument. If you ever meet one of those people, and maybe if you are one of those people, forgive me, I don't mean to be rude, but if you ever meet somebody who says, oh yeah, all sins are equally bad. All sins are equally bad. Really, murdering a child and stealing a stick of gum are equally bad. Yes, all sins are equally bad in God's eyes. No, they're not. God clearly says, I'm going to punish you commensurate with your sin. I'm going to punish you in keeping with your sin. Some sins are, anyways, we're not going to go there. But anyways, you could, if you meet somebody like that, say, hey, Luke told you to go to Revelation 18:7, so why don't you do that, bucko? And call him bucko, too. That'll teach him. That'll impress him, yeah. So, but you notice that what one of the things that's said here is, I am seated as a queen, and I will never be a widow, and I will never behold mourning. I'll never go into mourning. And it's a really interesting statement. It's this idea of arrogance, this arrogance that's there, and it's very similar again to Jeremiah. Now we've seen that a lot of sections of the Revelation really focus on certain Old Testament books. They're kind of themes that are connected. This place right here, this chapter 18, very similar to Jeremiah and Isaiah. A lot of similar themes here. Well, why? Well, Jeremiah and Isaiah were largely written in the context of the Babylonian captivity and about the Babylonian captivity. Well, what did they say to Jeremiah when Jeremiah kept telling everybody, the Babylonians are coming, they're going to destroy the city? Like, no, he's not. God would never allow that. That there will never be. And what did they cry out? The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord is here. God will never allow his temple to be destroyed. Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. Nebuchadnezzar's commander, destroyed it. And then what happened in 70 AD? Titus came along, destroyed it. But it's the same thinking. It's the same thinking. I will never be a widow. I will never suffer. Bad things will not happen to me. Did you have something? Oh, okay. Okay, gotcha. No, they didn't. They didn't last long after that. And yeah, it was absolutely terrible. And because of this, because of her arrogance, in 1 hour, that doesn't have to be a literal time frame, her plagues will be present. And that word, we've seen that word. Luke really likes this word for will be present. John uses it a fair amount in the Revelation as well. And it just means something's going to just be there. It's going to be there kind of suddenly. The idea is that it almost like it kind of sneaks up on you. But what's going to be there? Death, mourning, famine, and she'll be burned up in fire, a stronger form of the word burned, because the Lord God, the one judging her, is strong. Now that's an interesting phrase right here. I don't know if you guys noticed that, and I don't think I noticed that until right now. It doesn't say that he's just, doesn't say that he's righteous, doesn't say the Lord God is going to do this because he cares about his honor, doesn't say he's going to do this because he cares about his dignity or cares about his people. He says this is going to happen because the Lord judging her is strong. Obviously, Babylon thinks that it can resist God, that God is not strong enough to bring punishment or something like that. It's interesting. Think on that, I guess. It's interesting. Let's do verses 9 and 10 real quick. And the kings of the earth, the ones who fornicated and luxuriated with her, wept and beat their breasts upon her when they should see smoke and her fiery burning. From afar they're standing because of the fear of her torment, saying, woe, woe, the great city, Babylon, the strong city, because in 1 hour your judgment came. Okay, so we've already seen that she fornicates with the kings of the earth. So is Babylon a government? Possibly, but it's not a government in the way we think of it. It's something that spans governments. And the kings of the earth, some of them hate her, but other ones weep for her because they saw how powerful she was, and they saw
how useful she could be, and how they had gotten something out of that relationship with her. I'm going to move a little more quickly because we're running out of time tonight, because I talk too much. But if you want to talk about something, just interrupt me. I will not be offended. Verses 11 through 13, and by the way, before we go to that, notice the repetition of woe. We've already seen woe several times in the Bible, and the Greek word for woe is oui, so it's onomatopoeic. I never know which one that is, but it sounds like what it is. But it's called the great city, the strong city. Oh, see that reference to God is strong, the strong city. In 1 hour, your judgment came. There's a footnote. A footnote to this, and I give you a way to read this. I tried to spell this out phonetically because this little poetry, a lot of Greek poetry doesn't make a lot of sense to us by the sounds of it, but this one really does. Yeah, whatever. Ouai, opoles ha megale, babulon ha poles he ischura, hati ma'a hore, aelthe he krisiso. That was
terrible Greek. That's the worst Greek pronunciation I've ever done. But I'm just trying to read my little notes here. But it really is rhythmic, and it's really kind of bouncy. It's definitely poetic in a way that most of the time Greek poetry doesn't make any sense in English. But anyways, the merchants of the earth cry upon her. Okay, so the kings of the earth mourn over her. The merchants of the earth cry over her because nobody buys any of their cargo. And just looking at their cargo, gold, silver, precious stones, pearls, fine linen, purple, scarlet silk, all this stuff. But then look at the end. Horses, carriages, and bodies, and souls of men. The merchants of the earth are buying these things. And the souls of men, if we say the lives of men, a lot of people throughout history have looked at this and they've said, well, you know, whore Babylon, you know, the mystery Babylon, Babylon the prostitute. When it talks about the bodies and souls of men, they're talking about, you know, that people are falling into false religion. They're falling into one world religion, and it's leading them astray. And that's what it means. Well, I mean, that's probably true also. But these are the merchants of the earth that cry about this. And sure, people profit off of people being led astray. Absolutely. That's what this whole thing is about. But I think that when it says that they're selling bodies and souls of men, they mean it quite literally. People are buying human beings. The slave trade has never gone away. There are, by some estimates, more slaves now than there were, at least in the Roman Empire. I've heard some statistics. I don't know that those are accurate. But when you look at actual slavery in Africa, you look at 1 million Uyghur Muslims that are no better than slaves. They might as well be slaves. You look at slavery in Central Africa, you look at, and then of course the white slavery that we have here in America, with women and then children, of course, as well. This is not new, and to think that one world religion could not be associated with human trafficking is I would say naive at best. So is that the main point of this? Well, it ends there. I think that it's significant that that's the last thing mentioned. And then in looking at verses 14, and your seasonal fruit and the passion of the soul pass from you. Okay, that's just terrible. That's really bad. it doesn't make a whole lot of sense here in English. And I have a longer footnote here. The seasonal fruit of the passion of the soul pass from you. I'll read my footnote here just real quick. But the word Hapora technically means the time that starts when the star Sirius rises, and this corresponds to late summer, July, and early fall, when the fruit is ripening. By extension, it means the fruit itself. This is the only use of this word in the entire New Testament, and it's only used twice in the Greek Old Testament, Jeremiah 31:32 and 47:10. Though it's used not infrequently from Homer to the rabbinic writings, our term is the dog days, from Roman habit calling Sirius the dog star, because it is the eye of Canis Major, Orion's bigger hunting dog. Sirius is the brightest star in the sky and features in almost every astrological and mythological system known to man. So there's definitely something mythological about this,
There's this idea of the fruit that comes in the certain season when the certain stars are there. All the fat and the brightness, the torch brightness, has perished from you. They're wailing right here. This is the mourning of the merchants, right? So we have this list of what the merchants are saying, and then this is what the merchants are saying about it. They're saying, "Oh, Babylon, you were so beautiful. We loved you so much, but the fruit is gone, and your brightness is gone." And no longer will they find it. The merchants will never find that again. And the merchants, those enriched from her from afar, are standing because of the fear of her torment, standing and crying, "Woe, woe, the great city in which all the ones having boats in the sea were enriched out of her honored position, because in 1 hour it is deserted. Be gladdened upon her, heaven, and the saints, the holies, and the apostles and the prophets, because God judged your judgment out of her." So this is, again, the merchants are recognizing that God is the one punishing Babylon the Great. They're saying, yeah, Babylon persecuted your people. And it's really interesting. So verse 20, a lot of translations don't know what to do with verse 20. They almost they treat it, and I put this in footnotes, that people put this as an interjection, that maybe this is John who is saying this. So the merchants are speaking in verse 15, and then this little section here. But then in verse 20, I don't know how I had all these verses skipped. Oh, it looks like I missed a section here in my translation. Oh, guys, I am sorry. I did miss a section. Well, we're just not going to study that tonight. It must not be important. Anyways, we won't do that, Lukey. But anyways, woe, woe, the great city. So we see this woe, the great city. But then when we get to verse 20, they're saying no. They're saying this is good, and people should rejoice about this. So a lot of people have suggested that maybe John was interjecting here, that this is John telling the reader what to do, that this isn't the Babylonian merchants speaking. So you can do what you want with that. Maybe you agree with that, maybe you don't. But you look, yeah, I did miss that. Okay, so how she was so beautiful, like a woman clothed in the finest purple, like a woman, like scarlet linens decked out with gold and precious stones and pearls, and in one single moment all of the wealth of the city is gone, and all the ship owners and captains of the merchant ships and their crews will stand at a distance. They will weep as they watch the smoke ascend, and they will say, "Where in all the world is there another city like this?" And they will throw dust on their heads, and they will show great sorrow, and they will say, how terrible for the great city. She made us all rich from her great wealth, and now in a single hour it is all gone. And then you'll notice the NIV says, "But you, O heaven, rejoice." And so, like I said, a lot of people think that that's maybe John interjecting. So yeah, so that's my mistake there. I missed that little section in my translation. I was pretty tired at this point, so I can understand what you counted them three times. Okay, yeah. So that would I would say that, yeah, those are all the same. Yeah, repetition of that term. And again, go ahead.
Evidently, it was very sudden.
Yeah, very sudden.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I'm not opposed to it being an hour. I mean, when you think of a destruction, the smoke ascending, some kind of major event, it could only take an hour. God is certainly capable of that. The word hour in biblical theology, hour can mean a lot of things. Hour kind of means the same thing as day. The term day of the Lord, right? So you guys are all familiar with day of the Lord. Day of the Lord can be a 24-hour period, but typically it means the period of time in which God produces judgment. An hour is the moment in time when God produces judgment. That's my understanding of it. Now, you could disagree with me. Go ahead, Jim. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you're right, they didn't have timekeeping like we had, but they did have sundials. And they had, and if you're close to the equator, you're going to be able to break the time into hours that are similar. But again, I think I've mentioned this in sermons before. What I wear on my wrist is a product of the invention of the railroads. Until the railroads, noon was when the sun was at its zenith. And a lot of people got really mad when they invented railway time. When they invented time zones, people would be sitting there and their clocks would say noon and the sun was off. And they'd say, this isn't noon. How dare you? Like, noon is when the sun is at its peak. Well, because the day was always divided into 12 hours, the night was always divided into 12 hours. It's not always the same number of moments, but they just divided it into 12. And so they were okay with that. That's why we have the term the long hours of the night. So you're absolutely right. The idea that hour is this absolutely unflexible concept of what is an hour? 24 by 60 is 1840 seconds or something like that. They didn't have that idea. The idea that an hour was it's this many seconds and no more. No, that they didn't. That's not what they thought. No, it'd be 3,600 seconds. Well, they did have a calendar. The Jews had a calendar, and then the Romans had a calendar. That's actually where we get the word calendar. They called it a calends. But the weird thing is, if you ever want to put yourself to sleep, try figuring out the Roman calendar. The Roman calendar had four sections of every month. They had the Ides, the calends. Maybe there were two calends, I don't know, and then like one other section, I think. It was weird. They divided their month into sections, and they didn't really do days like we do, at least according to one source I've read. Now, the Jews did do a calendar similar to what we did, except their calendar was lunar. So they could say, well, I mean, God says, on the 14th of the month of Adar, do this. On the 7th of this month, do this. But their calendar was lunar, which meant that they had to have a makeup month. They had to have a 13th month that they added in some years to make up for lost time because they were using a lunar calendar, and they had to reconcile it back to the solar calendar so Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, could fall on the same time almost every time. Their concept of time was very different. We think time has to be really exact, and it is nice to have it exact. But they weren't really so concerned about that. They had a different concept of time. For them, time was very different. But my theory, you can disagree all you want. It's okay. Nobody's going to get mad. The day of the Lord is the period of time in which God judges. The hour that something happens is the moment in time when it happens, or in 1 hour. And it probably, I think what Jim says is true. I think it normally means that things happen suddenly, they happen unexpectedly, and they happen rapidly before people are able to even respond to it. So it happens so quickly that they can't even get the fire engines out of the garage because it happens so suddenly. And a strong angel raised up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, in this manner, in a violent rush, Babylon, the great city, will be cast, and it shall not be found. Look at the end of Jeremiah. What happens at the end of Jeremiah? Does anybody know off the top of their head? So at the end of Jeremiah, Baruch, who was Jeremiah's amanuensis, secretary, servant, takes a copy of the book of Jeremiah and throws it into the river. And he says, in this manner, the city of Babylon will fall. And then it'll be destroyed. And what's the idea? Well, he wraps the book in the scroll, he wraps it around a giant rock, and you throw a rock in water. You guys know what happens when you throw a rock in the water, right? And so it goes, and then a voice of a harping one. Oh, we've already heard the harps, right? We know about the harps. I'm going a little bit over. Please forgive me. And the one making music, and the one fluting, and the one trumpeting, they'll never be heard in you again. The voice of a millstone shall not be heard in you, and the light of a lamp won't be in there, and the voice of the bridegroom and the bride, and the merchants, and none of these things will be heard. Remember, again, there's another prophecy in the Old Testament about Jerusalem, except it's the opposite for Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, these sounds will be heard again. And I forget which prophet it was, but it was one of the exilic prophets, and he says, these things will again be heard in Jerusalem. Even though it was destroyed, all these things will be heard again. But then we look at what's going to happen to Babylon. Because your merchants were the great ones of the earth, and your sorcery, all the nations were deceived. Again, the word sorcery is the word pharmakē. It's where we get the word, I think it's pharmakē. It's where we get the word pharmacology. Pharmacology could mean witchcraft, it could mean sorcery, it could mean medicine, it could mean poison. We've talked about this a few months ago. It has a lot of meanings. And the blood of prophets and saints was found in all the ones slain upon the earth. Okay, so chapter 18, a lot of stuff. Million-dollar question. What is Babylon? What is Mystery Babylon? Anybody want to take a stab at it? Cincinnati has 7 hills. You know what? I like that. Let's say it's Cincinnati. You can almost pull a boat up to Cincinnati, you know? You go down the St. Louis. You're not going to get. But it's no, you can't. Nope. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and here's the problem. And I agree with you 100%. Babylon's also landlocked. The ancient city of Babylon was also landlocked. So when not as bad as Nineveh, but it was a little bit inland, in between in the Fertile Crescent. So a lot of people have said, well, maybe Tyre and Sidon. I don't know. I mean, you got the Persian Gulf there. I guess if Saddam took Kuwait, then maybe Iraq, which is modern day Babylon, would have a coastal port there in the Persian Gulf. Maybe, I don't know. But if we take this literally, that it is actual shipping, which shipping is still incredibly important for merchants, it has to be a city that's a coastal city. Well, it would make a lot of sense. Yeah, Ephesus was. Nope, not today. A couple miles, I think, at this point. Yeah, that slow river just dumped everything and filled in the estuary, and it's, yeah, quite a ways off at this point. And maybe tidal changes, too. You know, they've talked about that, like maybe tidal bringing sand and dumping it in there. Yeah, so what is Babylon? Honestly, if you want to say it's Rome, you're going to be in good company. If you want to say it's Jerusalem, I disagree, but you're going to be in good company. If you want to say it's actual Babylon, and at some point the nation of Iraq is going to maybe join together with a bunch of allies, a bunch of Arab allies, even though the Iraqis technically aren't Arabs, and maybe they're going to conquer Kuwait, and they're going to have shipping, maybe. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know what it is. I don't think it's a kingdom, though. I think that it's possibly, it's probably one world religion, and it's probably centered somewhere. I mean, who knows? Maybe it's the port of Los Angeles. Maybe that's what Babylon the Great is, right? So, Oh, man. You know what? I'm going to go get my tinfoil hat, and I'm going to agree with you. Yeah, but you got... But no, I mean, you're right. I'm teasing, but you're right. There is an enormous amount of power in that tiny island, Manhattan. And yeah, I mean, it's not unreasonable. So, yeah, I have no problem with that. I think the World Council of Churches used to be centered in New York, at least for a while. Now I got to think about that one. But yeah, let me get back to you with an answer on that, and after I do some noodling on it. But any other questions or comments? All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate you.